everybody. Welcome to another episode of What You Doing Podcast. This is part two of my chat with George Bickers from Three Sails Studios about their debut game, Mapamundi, the ecology and exploration RPG. Now, it's okay if you haven't listened to part one. This is the part that deals more specifically with Mapamundi as a game, as opposed to kind of discussions about Three Sails, its setup, you know, marketing the game, that sort of thing. Just a note here, we had some audio distortion from George's end during this interview. I tried to edit as much of the dead air out to work around it and edit some pauses and stuff out to try to deal with it. So if it sounds like George starts in the middle of a sentence or he cuts off a little strangely, it's because of that. I'm sorry for any annoyance it causes people. It was very frustrating to go back to the recording and see how bad it was. But I've done the best that I can. And I do think it's still very listenable overall. I want to thank George for coming on again. I will never be able to thank my guests enough. The links to everything we talk about, as always, will be in the show notes. So go ahead, check that out. But let's hop into part two.
Right. We are good.
I was just sitting here and I try to be very casual, very loose with the conversation. I want to let the conversation flow, you know, and obviously, you know, there's things that I want to hit, but I also want the conversation to be what the conversation is. And so I'm sitting here as we're having this conversation and it dawns on me a little slowly. I was like, we haven't really talked about the game, like, really. Yeah. And so it'd be very weird to release this and be like, yeah, this is George talking about Mapamundi. And we talk about, like, you know, community building and knowledge gathering and mutual aid for.
Yeah.
But obviously, I don't want to, you know, if you've got a big thing.
No, man, I'm good. Okay. I'm good to go.
So Mapamundi is a, you know, an RPG based solely on exploration. And you've implied that something happened in the world. This is one of those fun things where I have to ask the question that I kind of know the answer to. You know, tell us about the world of Mapamundi, the areas and stuff that you know players find themselves in.
Okay, so Mapamundi takes place in a world called Ecumeni, and Ecumeni means the inhabited place in Latin, I think it is. Jeremy named it. Jeremy names a lot of our stuff because I'm not great with coming up with like individual names. Big concept names, great, but individual names, I leave that to Jeremy. I did say that I wanted all of the continents to begin with E, though, so like we've got that. So
that's fun.
In this world, so this world is a parallel version of our own world. It looks incredibly similar to our world. If you look at the map, like, so we've got a map of the continent of Ivasu, which is our version of Eurasia and a bit of North Africa as well. And it's geographically very, very similar. There are some bits missing, like, for example, we've got no Spain or Italy. I can't remember what, and no Scandinavia. We kind of chopped them off for mechanical reasons. But basically, this continent of Ivasu is where the core book is set. Because we, you know, if we'd have done all of the world in one book, it'd have been an incredibly long book. So the continent is divided into 10 regions, and the regions run from Barbecia in the west, which is our version of like medieval France and the Low Countries. We wanted to give like a nod to people who are like, I like medieval castles and fantasy and stuff. So we're like, okay, you have medieval France. And then it runs all the way across to Zhoumang in the east, which is like our version of China. And then you've got like South Asia, Southeast Asia, kind of Russia and Siberia, you've got Mongolia and the Central Asian Republics, you've got the Middle East and the Arabian Peninsula, you've got North Africa, Eastern Europe, Central Europe, and the Balkans and Western Europe. It's a bit of a whistle-stop tour of the continent of Ivasu there. So what we kind of made the choice, because it's the kind of core concept of the game is like Pokemon but medieval bestiaries, like that was the initial inspiration. Mm-hmm. It's set in like a pan-global medieval period. Now, like lots of societies and cultures went through a kind of similar period, not always at the same time, and you wouldn't always call it a medieval period, but like for a Western, you know, English-speaking Western audience, medieval carries a lot of kind of historical and contextual weight. So like we went through and we chose like periods of time in different kind of regions' histories and kind of smoothed them out so they're all happening at the same time. What has happened in this world? This world used to be very connected. People used to travel. People used to share stories about their places, their homes, share them with other people. People used to travel across the oceans. this was, you know, like learning and exploration rather than discovery and colonialism. Like, we're, this is a very distinct, like, explicitly anti-colonial perspective. So, and to back that up, like, you don't just start in medieval France. You could start in any of the 10 regions. It's not like, this is the starting location. Mm. This is the core important one. And you're going out to the peripheries and discovering things that other people have known about for centuries. Like, you start wherever you want. But 100 years before the game, before the players start in the game, this thing called the Flux happened. Now, the Flux is... it's essentially an ecological catastrophe that lasted for 100 years. It's kind of weather and climate based, and it basically severed the world off from itself. So the continents, so we've got versions of North and South and Central America, we've got versions of Africa, Europe and like Eurasia and Australasia as well, Oceania, and all of those continents were cut off from one another, and then the regions within those continents were cut off from one another as well. So people have been like culturally isolated for a century by the time the game starts. And when the game starts, the Flux is just about starting to recede. Like, travel now seems like it might be possible again. So the players play as chroniclers, and they are trained by the Mappamundi Institute. And they've been being trained, the Mappamundi Institutes in all the different regions have been training chroniclers for 100 years in preparation for the time when the world would need to be reconnected again. And the Mappamundi Institutes are based on these old, like, travelers' guild lodges and stuff, where they used to be, like, they were, like, libraries and places where people would sleep and tell stories. They all kind of transformed into these centers of learning and training. So the Flux is this, like, no one knows what caused it. People have theories, people have been doing research, but no one knows really what caused it. But it is, for all intents and purposes, a climate catastrophe that has divided the world from one another. And so the world needs to be reconnected, and people need to learn about each other again, and people need to work out what's changed and what's the same and what's different. And that's what the Mappamundi Chroniclers are there to do. They're there to go out and write the new history of the world. And they do that by not just the history, but the ecology and biology and you know, a kind of like a map of, you know, the new maps need to be made, new biologies need to be written, new histories need to be written and understood. And that's the role that the players take on.
Groovy. I love it. I really like how much the game and by extension, the design is focusing on the idea of just like, yeah, stuff is different probably. So we should,
yeah,
go see what's up.
We don't know, so let's go out and check, right? Let's go out and have a look. And like, we haven't spoken to these people in 100 years. Like, we used to know these people. And like, so one of the things that, like, one of the things, Jeremy has done quite a lot of freelance work for Pathfinder. Mm-hmm. And one of the ideas he brought to the table, he really liked, like, in the Pathfinder Society stuff, he liked the idea of their, like, archetypes, their archetype characters whose stories, like, stories are told from their perspectives and stuff. And so he brought that idea across. And so we have four character classes. We call them licenses. You've got Archivist, Diviner, Fixer, and Guardian. And Joel drew the four designs, and we used those. Those are featured on, like, the character creation pages and the relevant sections for each one. And then next to each of them, Jeremy wrote a story from that specific character's perspective. And the four of them are part of a traveling group of chroniclers who are going out into the wilds for the first time to fulfill the Mappamundi mission. And we liked this so much that every time Joel was drawing one of our big full page regional art pieces, I was like, make sure the chroniclers are in there. Those same four chroniclers. And so as you read through the book, you see these chroniclers go on this journey. And I really, really like that. Like, there's something really special about it. And like, it's allowing players to, like, see the point of the game in the game. Mm-hmm. They're able to see the game material reinforce the point of the game, which is get your party together and go out on this unbelievable, amazing journey that no one has done before. You get to be the ones doing it. You get to be the ones reconnecting the world. And, like, it's one of those characters, the Archivist, the Archivist, her story, Jeremy wrote her. She's actually, her grandparents were, so the four chroniclers, the archetype chroniclers, are from Barbecia, which is, you know, this medieval France region. And but Jeremy wrote the archivist character. Her parents, her grandparents were from Tir Hakeim, which is the kind of Middle East Arabian Peninsula region. And them and their community of travelers were isolated in Barbecia and have kind of set up their own little neighborhood in the city. And so, like, part of her story is returning to Tir Hakeim, which is a land that she feels both is and isn't her own. She's kind of part of this diaspora that's been cut off by the flux. And, like, we've really lent into that with different bits of flavor text throughout the book, which is full. Like, the book is, like, it's 220 pages. The regional guides take up 100 pages. The Cardieri, which is loads and loads and loads of, like, environment-specific lore and story hooks, takes up another 36 pages. Like, more than half the book is just lore.
Mm-hmm.
Lore and world building and stuff. So we've been able to seed all these different bits in throughout, which has been really, really nice. But like, the game is designed to give people a sense of wonder and give people, because we're so divorced from the natural world. So many of us are so divorced from the natural world. And like, I'm a city boy at heart, man. Like, I live right in the middle of Manchester. You know, like, this is like the first city of the Industrial Revolution. Like, I'm looking out the window now. All I can see is brick terraces. If I look out in that direction, this direction, there's just brick terraces everywhere. And I love being in a city. But I kind of, because of that, I also like, when I do see something, so there's a few parks around us, and we've got a dog. We take the dog for a walk. And in the 80s, someone released a breeding pair of like parakeets into one of these parks. And now these three parks are full of these like tropical looking parakeets, and it's amazing. And like, I see in the winter when all the leaves are off the trees, you just see these flashes of green in the trees and stuff, and like, that feeling is so minor of like, isn't nature amazing? But that's what Mapamundi really gives to people. And it's seeing that happening in real time when you're running a game for people is, it's so beautiful. And like, it's what we were talking about earlier on, that like, that perfect marriage of like, when the theme meets mechanic. That's what Mapamundi is intended to do, is to be like, you can go out and explore and build. Crucially, you as a player, you play a huge part in building this world as you want to see it. And we do that through our shaping mechanic.
Tell me about shaping. Again, I have to ask these questions like I don't know. But I gave a good flip through the preview document. We'll talk about shaping in a second. Flipping through the preview document, and you know, I just grabbed a couple pages. I was given it a very, very broad glance. But a thing that very quickly caught my eye was advancement, because I enjoy, you know, like, for video games, like, I enjoy JRPGs, I enjoy strategy games, I enjoy games that, like, you can really get granular with your characters, with what you want them to do.
Yeah.
And so I just settled on advancement. And the thing that I really enjoyed seeing was that a core part of advancement in this game is having to fail.
No, 100%. Yeah. You absolutely have to fail, otherwise you can't advance.
Yeah. It's a thing I guess I shouldn't say I'm shocked more games don't do more, because in, you know, Power by the Apocalypse, Blades in the Dark, you know, Forge in the Dark genre games, you know, a lot of that is you fail and so you gain an XP, and so you kind of, you know, that's the main progression mechanic. But for games that are not of that genre, kind of not of that lineage, it's very uncommon. It's very uncommon to have failure be such an important part of progressing your character.
Yeah, I get you. So I think that for me, this is an interesting one, because obviously this is something that I now. So Blades in the Dark was definitively an inspiration for what we've done with Mapamundi, but I think we've done it in a kind of very different way. Mm-hmm. So like, prior to this, I'm a man that's lived many lives, and one of my lives was an academic. So I did my PhD here in Manchester in American studies. Like, my PhD was on like a radical American social politics and like spatial theory and stuff, like anarchist spatial theory. And so I'm used to being in an environment where you have to fail to get better. Like, you know, that's what academia is. It's a constant process of learning and failing and getting better and getting better. And like, one way of looking at our chroniclers is that they're like adventure academics. I mean, Christ, one of them is an archivist. Like, it's like, because so Mappamundi characters don't level up. Like, they don't level up. And I think this, it was a conscious decision when we were doing the design, because I was like, these are normal people. They're not elves or like god-blessed humans or barbarians or orcs or dwarves or whatever. They're not like, they're not fantasy, but they're normal people. And that's a really core part of the theme of Mappamundi, is like normal people going out and doing something highly unnormal, like in a situation that's very, very much not normal. So like the characters don't level up because they're normal human beings. Instead, their dice level up, because so Mappamundi has four abilities. You've got traversal, which is your ability to move through the world. You've got deduction, which is your ability to kind of understand the world. You've got observation, which is your ability to kind of witness and notice the world. And then you've got exploration, which is the drive to put all those things into action. So when you build your character, you have four dice. You start with D4s and D6s. You put two D4s on one, you put a D4 on one of those abilities, a D4 on another one, a D6 on another one, and a D6 on another one. And as you use those abilities in game, as you roll your dice, that's what we call training. So as you make traversal checks, you are gaining traversal training because you are being exposed to the thing that you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And so you mark every time you succeed with a specific dice, you mark that down. Every time you fail, you mark that down. And then once you've accumulated enough training, which bear in mind is that combination of failing and succeeding, you can upgrade your dice. So a D4 becomes a D6, becomes a D8, becomes a D12. So if I want to upgrade my D6 in traversal to a D8, I need to succeed in traversal 8 times and I need to fail at traversal 4 times. And I can engineer situations in which I'm going to fail. I can attempt something that I know I can't do to guarantee a fail, and you're going to suffer a consequence for it, but you've also learned something. So the idea is that as our chroniclers are more and more exposed to the things that they do, the idea is that they get better at them, and so they upgrade their dice, and so they're more capable of more difficult things. So failure is like an integral part of that, because you learn as much from getting something wrong as you do from getting it right. In fact, you probably learn more, because you know all the things that you don't need to do anymore in order to try and do the thing that you need to do. So like, that was a big part of Mappamundi's advancement, and is actually something that I'm carrying forward to a lesser or a greater extent in our future games as well. Like, I like that as an advancement thing. I like the idea that you're not just becoming better. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I've killed enough goblins. Now I'm more charismatic. Like, no, I'm sorry. No, that's not the way it works. Like, cause my design philosophy has become the studio's motto, which is the real world done fantastically. Like, I am a big proponent of the fact that the real world is interesting enough that I don't need stories told through the perspective of elves and dwarves. I've got a lot of time for those. I love those kinds of games. Like, I'm thinking specifically of like Spire, like Rowan, Rook and Deckard, Spire as like dark elves as an oppressed people. Mm-hmm. Like, I love that. I absolutely love that. But you could very easily take the elves out and put real humans in, and exactly the same story could be told. And so we've made the choice to be like, all our games are either in the real world or in an incredibly close version of the real world, which is where Mappamundi falls into the latter of those two, because obviously there's monsters. But monsters are just, you know, fantastical megafauna anyway. So like, they're basically normal things.
I mean, dinosaurs were in the real world. So
exactly right. They're this is the thing. They look like fantastical creatures. They're just monsters. They're monsters that we don't have anymore. Mm-hmm. Right? So yeah, like that kind of failure forward. I think we call it failure forward as like in our key principle section. We're like, failure is a good thing. Like, embrace failure because you need it to advance. Like, don't be, because this is, I think a lot of games punish failure so heavily that people they get analysis paralysis and they're scared to do anything in case they fail because they don't know what the consequences are going to be. In Mappamundi, if you fail a traversal roll and fall out of a tree, you might get hurt, but like that's about the worst thing that's going to happen. Like, you can die in Mappamundi. It's possible to die despite the fact there's no combat. Like, the world is still a dangerous place. But by encouraging failure, I feel like we're liberating people from that like, oh, I can't do anything in case I mess it up. Mm-hmm. Like, the reward for success is not worth the punishment for failure. In Mappamundi, failure is rewarded with advancement.
And it's like you said, like, you as a person, as a real life person, you do thousands of things a day. You're not perfect at them every single time. And like you said, you learn as much from failing. And so I think it's just such an interesting way to mechanize that. And it's a thing that always, like, bugs me in games, is when it's like, well, I'm going to use my strength because my strength is the thing that I'm best at. And so to do anything else would be suboptimal. And that's a bummer.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that I'm against metagaming. I love metagaming. Metagaming is an important part of gaming. Guess what? You're playing a game, you're metagaming. Yeah. But it just always bums me out when it's like, well, I'm playing a fighter, so I guess I'm going to attack it because that's the thing I'm good at, because anything else is at best a waste of time, or at worst, like, I'm going to get fucked up.
But this is the thing, right? This is like, this kind of returns to one of the things we were talking about earlier on, but like, in terms of like, when I was like, stick to your convictions with Mappamundi, you just take the combat out. Because if the only thing you've got is a hammer, the whole world is a nail, right? Every problem is a nail to be hammered in. If you've got a sword, everything is a threat. Everything is something to be killed, because that's the way you get better, right? And so our class, our character licenses, they have archetypes. Like, you've got an archivist, a diviner, a fixer, and a guardian. But one, it's not like, unlike with a fighter or a wizard or a bard, or, you know, or a monk, these kinds of things, they can do what they do. Mm. And that's not what the real world is like. Like, that's not how things work. And like, I'm not like a simulationist. I'm not saying every game has to be completely accurate to real life. That would be ridiculous. But people can do more than one thing. Like, you could be playing a fighter who's also an incredible poet, and maybe if the game mechanics are like, you have to fight things because you're a fighter, even though your character might also be a beautiful poet, you might be able to solve a problem by writing a poem about it, or remembering something from a poem that you've written or read that you really liked. But actually, the optimal thing to do, as you said, is just to stab the thing to death. And you, like, that, like, it's weird. Someone asked us, they're like, oh, you've only got four character types, so you're not going to add any more in. And I was like, well, no, I don't think we need to. Like D&D, to return to D&D, has so many character types, but actually the choice you have is severely limited, mm-hmm. because once you've chosen one, that's your solution to every problem. If you choose one of ours, an archivist might be better at observing and deducing. It doesn't mean they can't also be, like, hella stacked and able to protect people from monsters. Our abilities and our character licenses don't work. They're not restrictive, they're permissive. Mm. And like, by restricting the choices, you've actually enabled, like, the initial choices, you've actually made more play styles possible. You can be an archivist who loves their books and can also lift, you know, can also bench press 400 pounds. Like, you can do both of those things, because we don't have a strength attribute and we don't have an intelligence attribute. It's like, the way that I always look at things is, the games that I design try to encourage player skill, not character skill. Like, there's a whole bunch of problems with the OSR community, obviously. I don't think that goes without saying. There's a whole bunch of problems. But there's also loads of people who are on our side of things who love the OSR and are doing really, really good things with it. Our character sheets are really simple. You have four abilities. None of them are, like, directly telling you that none of them, you can't be like, your traversal skill is not going to help you lift a rock. You need to work out how you're going to lift that rock as a player. Like, one of the things I don't like about D&D 5e, and I, you know, I'm assuming it's the same for 5.5 or 2024, whatever we're calling it. Like, if there's a hidden trap in a room, I hate the fact that you walk in and roll a perception check and you're like, are there any traps in here? I've rolled a perception check. No. Like, what are you? Like, are you, like, I mean, I was about to say, are you magic? You probably are. But the fact that everyone can just roll to see if there's a hidden trap defeats the point of there ever being a trap. Like, if you think there's a trap in a room, explore the room and tell me how you deduce if it's there or not. And if you don't, tough, you got caught in the trap. Right. But at least you tried to work it out. You tried as a player, mm-hmm. you tried, rather than just relying on a line on your character sheet and rolling a dice. Like Mappamundi as a game is set up to put player skill first, but it's also a very simple system. Like I said, it's 6 pages of rules. And more recently, I discovered the terms player-facing versus GM-facing rules. And like different people write in different styles. And I after discovering these terms, I realized I'm very much like, I write for the GM. I give the players the rules they need. And then the rest of the book is like aimed at the GM.
Mm-hmm.
Because the GM is facilitating play. So in our book, in Mappamundi, the GM, we don't do gods, we don't do masters at 3Cell Studios. So like our GM is a narrator, and their job is to narrate the play and to facilitate the play. And so they are the ones that need to know the rules. But again, there's only 6 pages of them. The players can get away with the 1-page how to play summary. And then the narrator just helps them facilitate that because, you know, it's such a simple system that it's liberating in how simple it is. And it allows players to be players rather than just dice rollers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're not just interpreting a sheet and rolling a dice in the right situation. That's like Skinner box behavior. Like, the light comes on, I press the button, I get a reward. The light comes on again, I press the button, I get a reward. Like, D&D, when it's run badly, could reduce you to that. Like, it reduces you to basically a random number generator, and I don't like it. And so Mappamundi is designed, the play is designed to have you as the player doing this. The character is your direct avatar in the world, but it's you acting through them. And your player, your character might do different things. I'm not saying they have to be like a self-insert. Your character might be different to you, but you are piloting them through the world. So what you think is important.
Well, and so you mentioned the OSR. I think, you know, a great tenet in the OSR, or, you know, kind of a guideline that I think is very strong in Mappamundi, is the idea, like you said, there's 4 stats. The thing I really like about the stats is none of them key specifically to, like you said, like physical attributes. They're not inherently telling you...
Like, traversal is close. Like, traversal is how am I moving through the world, but, like, it's not how strong am I or right. How quick am I. You know, it's a guide. It's not a number on a scale.
Right. It's not, am I strong enough to carry this rock? It could be for any number of things. And, you know, I like open-ended skills like that, but a thing that I feel like is pretty prevalent in the OSR community is okay, you have your character, and now we put the book away, and now we play the game.
That's exactly what we're aiming for. Yeah, it's exactly what we're aiming for, is that you as a player, you should be able to read that 1-page how to play summary, build your character, and then never have to look at that book again if you don't want to.
Right.
And the narrator should be able to run a game without without constantly having to look up rules.
Right.
Like, occasionally they might dive in and be like, oh, I can't quite remember what this one is. But like, again, with very, very little learning, you should be able to play this game and have great fun, and it'd be satisfying and profound and funny and sad and beautiful and all these things without you constantly having to flip back and through pages. How do I resolve combat? How does initiative work? What's the modifier on this weapon? Oh, like, the second someone says roll for initiative, it makes me feel sick.
What's the grapple system in Mappamundi? What score do I have to roll over?
The closest we have to a grapple system is one of our interactions is subdue, and you literally just have to say, right, I'm going to try and subdue that creature.
There you go.
And the narrator might be like, okay, have you got any relevant skills, which are all narrative skills? So you might have steady hands, which might help you hold something, but you don't have to roll on that. You say, I've got steady hands, and I think it would allow me to do this. And if the narrator's like, okay, but that monster's huge and you're going to try and subdue it, I'm going to get you to give me a traversal roll as well, just to see if you can get in the right position to grab it. Like, that's it. That's the grapple mechanic. That's it. That's it done.
So you mentioned skills, and skills was the thing I was flipping through the book, and I was like, okay, I got to ask about this because I can tell there's a lot going on, but with my very quick glance, I didn't grab the entire thing. And again, I took a very quick glance. This is not a statement on the game. How does advancement work? We talked about upgrading dice and all of that. How does advancement in those licenses work?
Okay, so with skills, every license has its own skill path. They're skill trees. We call them skill paths because they're arranged horizontally rather than vertically. Now, I'm a massive JRPG and strategy game fan as well. I love a skill. I love a tech tree. Mm-hmm. Absolutely love it. Every game I design has some form of it in there. So you start off, you choose, like every license has its own skill path and has 9 starting skills. And you are given 4 of those skills for free at the start of the game when you build your character. And then as you, each of those skills is linked to one of the 4 abilities. So it works in a similar way to training, right? So when I say, I'm going to grab my book here. So I've got my hard copy of the quick start guide here. And I'm going to flick through and I'm going to go to the skills pages, which are earlier in the book. Right, so fixers. The fixer has, so all of our skills are narrative. We provide you with a title of the skill, the name of the skill and the ability that it's linked to. And then we give you a couple of lines, like 4 or 5 lines of like flavor text for that skill. But the way the skills are used and interpreted and where they're relevant is entirely up to the player. So they are always advocating for how they want to use it. So the fixer, it got the skill we spoke about earlier on, steady hands, right? Steady hands is actually, weirdly, it's a deduction skill because like fixers are about like, some fixers are like diplomats and poets and relationship people, and other fixers are like engineers and mechanics and, you know, they mess around with stuff. So steady hands is a deduction skill because like it's about, and I'll read the skill out to you. Years of fiddling with objects, be they watches and clocks, axles and cogs or books or bindings, have given you the steady hands necessary to start assembling or repairing just about anything, whether a mechanical contraption or a broken bone. So that is designed to give the player an indicator of what this skill could be used for and what scenarios it's relevant in. So when a situation comes up where steady hands might be relevant, the narrator would ask for a test. Normally it'd be a deduction test, or maybe it could be any of the 4 abilities. But the fixer player is like, actually, I've got the steady hand skill unlocked, and I think that would allow me to do this thing in this way. If the narrator agrees, they're like, good, fine, great. You don't need to make the test. You don't need to roll your dice because the skill does it. Sometimes it might be, okay, but this one's particularly difficult. So like roll the test, but we're going to make the test easier to pass because you've got steady hands. So when you use that, you gain a point of what we call expertise. So it's still EXP, but it's expertise instead of experience, because like training, you are getting better at your job. So if you use steady hands, you gain a point of deduction expertise. If you use gift giver, which is an observation skill, you get an observation point of expertise. And when you've accumulated enough expertise, you can unlock another skill along the tech tree that is linked to that expertise. So I've gained X number of deduction expertise points. That looks like a good deduction skill. I'm going to unlock that one. And therefore, again, the advancement is there. Mm-hmm. And then once you spend those points, you erase them and you start building them up again. And the way you unlock a skill, I designed this to be a conundrum for the player. The way you unlock skills, a skill costs the same number of points as the value of the dice linked to that ability. So if I wanted to put a deduction skill and I've got a D6 in deduction, it's going to cost me 6 deduction. So the conundrum that the players have to do is they have to work out, do they want to make their tests easier by upgrading their dice? But if they do so, they're making unlocking skills more expensive. Or do they want to keep their dice at a low level and make unlocking skills cheaper, but run the risk of not succeeding when they're having to make tests? So I liked that little interplay between like, how do you want to specialize? There's a balance to be played with both of them. So skills have that narrative function, but they're linked to one of the abilities, and that therefore gives you expertise, which can be spent to unlock those new skills. And as you move up the skill paths, I nearly said tech trees there. Did you hear that? As you move up the skill paths, you move to what we call specializations. So each license also has 3 specializations. Let's have a look. So I can remember some of them off the top of my head, but not all of them. So the archivist has 3 specializations. The archivist can specialize as a cartographer, a biologist, or a historian. The diviner can specialize as a cartomancer, an osteomancer, so they're bone readers, because our dice are called bones, or an augur. Fixers can specialize as envoys, fabricators, or scavengers. And guardians can specialize as wardens, survivalists, or trappers. And then we allow you to multi-class as well if you want. You can combine different specializations from different licenses, and you get endorsed, what we call endorsements for them. So a guardian who has the warden specialization and any archivist specialization can become a veterinarian. And they get special things for being a vet. Like they get special things that they can do. And like, so there's, you know, there's all these different things you can do. I love character building and I love it to be deep, but I also want it to be quick and easy to do. Like I want there to be loads of choices, but the initial step of the character should be like that. 5 minutes, I'm done. I've chosen my skills. I've picked my interactions. I've assigned my dice. Let's go. I'm ready to go. But the customization that you can do in Mappamundi with your characters is really deep. What routes do you take through the skill path? Do I decide do I want to master being an archivist by getting all three specializations? Or do I want to be a veterinarian? So I take the guardian, I do some guardian skills and I do some archivist skills, and then I become this particular thing. There's enough there that players can really sink their teeth into without it ever being overwhelming to start off with.
Yeah, and what I like about that, you know, you at the end of the day, you have a character sheet that has the dice, and you're just like, you don't have numbers, you just have dice, and then you just have words, you just have descriptors of your character's abilities and skills and experiences.
That's literally, it is that simple, and that's how I wanted it. That's just how I wanted it to be. I want you to look at a word or look at a phrase and be like, oh, Carl, that applies here. Oh, my fixer's got a silver tongue. Like, I can talk my way into things. When we first designed it, the skills were actually mechanical. They were giving, like, modifiers and boosts and stuff. Mm-hmm. I ran the first playtest, and I was like, I don't like this at all. Like, I'm getting rid of this straight. Because, like, people were saving them for the right moment. And that wasn't part of the fail forward. That contravened the fail forward, decisions that we'd made. People weren't going to, they were like, oh, I've got this. It's going to be great if this situation happens. And lo and behold, that situation never happens. And someone goes through the game having never used one of their skills. And they're disappointed and that feels bad. And then it's redundant design. Because why would you ever choose it if that's not going to happen? So the narrative skills allow that conceptual and creative space for players to exist in. And like, this is really at the core for Mappamundi. This is where shaping really comes in. So shaping is the mechanic that I am proudest of for codifying it, because this shaping happens around every good TTRPG table. One of our playtesters described shaping as adding flavor text to the world. What Mappamundi does is it specifically codifies it, and it gives players permission to add detail to the world in really profound and interesting ways. The only rule of shaping is don't erase something that someone else has already added. It's yes and. Mm-hmm. And sometimes from the narrator, it's no, but. Like, that, you can't do this because that would be erasing something, but have you considered this instead? So, like, shaping... The world that we have created in Mappamundi is a framework that we want people to come and dress up and bring to life. And the narrator plays that role as well. So Mappamundi is, at its heart, is a collaborative storytelling and world-building exercise that's also a good game. And so, if I do say so myself, so basically, like, as players are going out into the world, they are encouraged to add details to things that the narrator is introducing. And then there are specific points in the game where that is the purpose of play. So, like, Mappamundi's got three phases: the research phase, the journey phase, and the encounter phase. In the journey phase, where players are playing through the journey deck that their actions have put into, you know, their actions have contributed to, whenever a new location is reached, the narrator specifically asks the players to tell them what it looks like. What does it look like, smell like, sound like? What can you see? What are the flowers like? Can you see any wildlife? What's the weather like? What's the vibe? And you go round the table and everyone adds details. And some players find this initially really intimidating, and I get it. Like, they want to just be there to play rather than taking that creative role. But even the most terrified players, within a few minutes of doing this, are shaping with the best of them. And every time we've run the game, I've had shivers go down my spine at least once from something like beautifully profound that someone has put into this world. And like, I've run Root and Branch, which was our pre-written adventure that we released with the pre-release guide. I've run that a lot of times, and I've heard it being run a lot of times as well. And every single time it's different, with the same cards and the same monster with the same behaviors. Every time it's different. And it's not just like, oh, they went left and they went right. The world is different every single table. And that is like the most rewarding thing. And like, when we were first designing Mappamundi, like, we put shaping in there. Like, I was very insistent that we were going to put it in rather than like as a thing, rather than just some guidance. We were going to put it in as a thing. But it only had like half a page in the rules, like quite a tight half page. And as we were doing our initial playthroughs and playtests and stuff, people were like, yeah, I really enjoyed the game. I liked the monsters. I liked the vibes, liked the dice system, blah, blah, blah. Maybe think about changing this. But every single one of them was like, that shaping mechanic, though, that was really good. That was really special. And after a while, I was like, we're really onto something with this. And so I made a bigger deal out of it. And then it became so central to the game that like that's the experience that people really remember. Everyone wants to have a hand in the world they're playing in. Everyone wants that, and Mappamundi gives players the explicit permission and space to do that. I really, really like that. And it's all, again, it's all tied in, right? It's that marriage of theme and mechanics again into a system. That's what we've got. And like, it's I really, really, really enjoy it. I'm so glad that we've codified it. And again, it's being carried forward into every other game I decide. Like, I just love it so much. It's being carried forward.
It's such a great idea, because like you said, it's not doing anything groundbreaking, but it's codifying it. It's putting it into the gameplay loop. It's explicitly saying, this is when it happens. This is how it affects. This is when you can bring it up, and making that clear in a guideline perspective, which I think is great. If for nothing else, then people might play Mappamundi and then be like, oh, this is a thing I can do in other games, and this would just improve playing other games.
I really want people to take it into other games, and I want people who are playing Mappamundi either as players or narrators to bring it into other games as GMs, to like create that space, allow your players to do this, because it makes your job as the person running the game so much easier. And just the stuff they come up with is it's incredible. It's absolutely incredible, the things that they do. I just love it. It makes me makes me happy every single time.
The other thing that's amazing, what I really appreciate about it, it's a game that's explicitly about exploration. You know, it's a game where the player characters are explorers. They're exploring. They're re-exploring the world. They're rediscovering things. And how unexciting would it be to just be told all the things that you discover?
Exactly. So Thomas Manuel, who runs the Yes Indeed podcast, he works with Rascal now. He's one of the co-owners of Rascal, and he does the indie games. I forget what the actual mailing list is called now.
I think it's the Indie RPG Newsletter.
I look forward to that every single week. Every weekend when it comes through, it's the first thing I read. As soon as it comes through, straight reading it. And one of the weekly newsletters came out while we were at UK Games Expo, and I was out taking a cigarette break and reading it. And he was like, one of the problems I have with like a lot of games is this idea of like received or common knowledge. And he gave an example, which is like, if you are a cleric of a certain religion in your game, so someone asks you where the nearest temple to your god is, you have to ask the DM, who tells you, and then you tell the person that asked. Like, you would know that. And what shaping allows for in Mappamundi, if someone asks, oh, you're from this region, or you've been here before, you've been to this city before, where's this? The narrator keeps their mouth shut. The player says where it is. The player decides where it is. The player adds the detail, because it's knowledge that the character would have. So the player should be the one bringing that knowledge out into the world. And that's, I really love that as a kind of, as a creative space for players to play in as well.
Yeah. It feels so much more like it, it exists in the storytelling game space, and it's a great sort of breakpoint from the lineage. I feel like, and this is a, you know, this is just an observation. It's not a problem. You know, a lot of Powered by the Apocalypse games can feel very similar because a lot of the mechanics are similar, and so your flow of play is the same, and so the games can start to feel a little similar, and they can feel less exciting from one to another. Mappamundi takes just a lot of the ideas and a lot of the sort of GM ideas and a lot of the GM guidance and player ideals and puts it in a completely different package, you know, and I think is just sounds so exciting to get to the table. It sounds so exciting. It feels like there's so many games that are starting to come out that feel like what people think D&D feels like.
Mate, you could not be more correct there. So what we were saying earlier on about like people bouncing off of D&D because it's not what they thought, it's not what they wanted it to be. So many of us in the indie space know that because we had the same experience and we're creating the experiences we wanted to see. And that's, for me, that's what Mappamundi is. It's like, this is what I wanted role-playing to be. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of things I wanted role-playing to be. Mappamundi is one part of that. But like, again, to return to that quote from Luke from Merkmale in his review, it's like, this is a love letter to world building. That's exactly, like, I couldn't have said it better myself. He summed up exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to give people the world building experience that I wanted. And when you're a writer or a musician or a designer, the number one piece of advice people give you is write for yourself, because other people are going to share your, other people want what you want. You mm-hmm. just need to find them. And that's what we've done. Evidently, that's what's happening with Mappamundi. Like, as we speak, that's what's happening with Mappamundi. And it's beautiful. I love it. I get a bit overwhelmed by it at times, being like, I designed this for me, but I designed it for you as well. Mm-hmm. I know you're going to enjoy it as much as I enjoy it because I designed it for you. Like, I made this for you and I want you to enjoy it.
Just you pushing the book into someone's face. I made this for you!
With my blood.
Okay, so two more questions because I know it's getting late. So this might be a big question, especially now in the middle of the Kickstarter. And I know you've mentioned that you're working on two other games, like, as a studio. And I think this is an interesting question because I think a lot of designers are going to think differently about this question. What's next for Mappamundi?
Oh, what's next? There's so much. There's so much. So we obviously, this was always going to be contingent. It was always going to be contingent on the Kickstarter because we needed to know how popular Mappamundi was.
Sure.
How much of an audience there was, how many people would want it, but would want to see more from it as well. And like this, so this is like, we're 20 days left on the Kickstarter. Like, the book's not even out there yet. So this is, it's early days in terms of like fixed plans, but we have very clearly stated that, you know, Mappamundi, the world of Ecumeni, is based on the real world. We have explored two and a tiny bit of a third continent, so Eurasia and a small bit of Africa. The obvious routes for expansions are we want to do the Americas, we want to do the rest of that, we want to do the rest of Africa, we want to do Oceania, and we want to do an islands and seas expansion as well. So like that's four possible expansions. Now the likelihood is that we would probably combine some of those together.
You don't need to do America. As far as anyone is concerned, the official representative of America, because that's how it works these days, apparently. You just not. It's fine. You just skip us.
Oh, think about it. Like this, the incredibly rich history, ecological history of the Americas, like North, Central, and South America. Yeah. There's so much stuff there. Like, in a way, like we could have started with the Americas. But like, so there's, you know, there's a minimum, that's a minimum for like four expansions there. We, like I said, we'd probably combine continents into books, so the books are of a reasonable, like of a like reasonable length of production. But in terms of like actual fixed plans for what those books look like, we're not sure yet. But we know what our approach is going to be. We know what we want to do. We also know that like because the Kickstarter is going as well as it is, we're now in a position to do what we always wanted to do, which is hire people from the regions or with lived experience of those regions rather than just using cultural consultants. Like, cultural consultants are vital and very, very important and provide an excellent service. But ideally, you should be getting someone from with lived experience of a place to write about that place rather than what we had to do this time, which is Jeremy and I wrote them, and then we went to cultural consultants with lived experiences to do that. So that's our plan. And because the Kickstarter is doing as well as it is, we're going to be in a position financially to do that, which is great. It means we can put our money where our mouth is. We also have, so as part of the Kickstarter, every Kickstarter backer is getting a PDF, two free PDFs, in fact. One is the solo rules, the solo supplement.
My partner is very excited about that. She, at the beginning, she was like, make sure you ask them if they're solo stuff, because this is really exciting. And then I was looking at the Kickstarter, and she's like, oh, it's included. Great. Fantastic.
Everyone gets that for free. And the solo supplement will always be free, because it's going to be like a 15, 20 page PDF. So that will always be free. But the other PDF that people are getting, Kickstarter backers are getting for free, is called Chronicles of the Wilds, Volume 1. And that contains four pre-written adventures. So Root and Branch from the original, from the pre-release guide, is being condensed and edited and formatted differently. And then we've got Jeremy is writing two more. And then we've got Kat Southern, Kat the Law Mistress, is she's written another one for us, which is great. Really, really good. So we are also planning more Chronicles of the Wilds expansions. We want at least one adventure for every region that we've covered in the core book. And then the idea would, we'll do those as PDFs, and hopefully at one point we'll be able to do those as like a like an anthology book as well, which would be really, really nice. So we've got big plans for Mappamundi, really big plans. And the fact that the Kickstarter is going as well as it is suggests that there's an appetite for those. We're not just going to start churning stuff out. We want it to be considered and properly, properly high quality. So we're going to take our time with them. And obviously we've got other games in the pipeline as a studio as well. But like Mappamundi is always going to be on our radar. There's been speculative talk about a future Mappamundi set 100,000 years in the future, where humanity is returning to Ecumene. That's very, very, very speculative.
That's interesting, though.
You're the first person I've confirmed that to publicly outside of the studio, so you've got yourself an exclusive right there. But like that, if we do that, we will do that once we've finished all of the continents that we've got, and then we'll look at, I think the working title is Mappa Galactic or something like that. But yeah, so that's so we've got like Mappamundi. It's not just a one and done. We're not, you know, people are like, we want to keep, and this is true, this is going to be true of all of the games that we put out, when and where possible, we want to continue to support those games, whether it's like official adventures that we're writing, and whether it's expansions and supplements and all stuff like that. Like we're committed to carrying the, and I hate to say the brand, but we're committed to carrying the brand forward.
No, it's great. I think it's an interesting question to ask, because not every game needs to be a product line, you know? And I think it's part of what people should think of as designers, of like, does this need to be a thing? Is this it? Is this good? Or even just like, yeah, I'm going to take this system and I'm going to revise it. And, you know, like a second edition is going to be a different game, you know? And so like, it's going to exist as this, and then I might do a different theme. I might do a different thing. But I think it's an interesting question to be like, what's next? What do you see? And honestly, while we were talking originally, when you were describing the world, my first thought was how interesting a CRPG version, an SEA CRPG version, a Southeast Asia RPG version would be, you know, something that takes a focus on, you know, Philippines, Malaysia, that area, and sort of mirror the focus. So hearing all that is fantastic. I was very excited to see when I was looking at videos during lunch that Asians Represent talked about it and had an AP, and I went, okay, well, they did an AP, so it probably isn't garbage.
Daniel, who founded Asians Represent, is an incredible friend of both mine and Jeremy's. In fact, he introduced me and Jeremy. Like, Daniel is directly responsible for for Mapper Mundi coming into being, because he introduced the two of us back when I was working on a miniature war game. That's how Jeremy and I met. But Jeremy is also part of Asians Represent, so we've got a little bit of it in.
Mm-hmm.
But Daniel has been like, he loves the game. He's incredibly excited about it. You know, he did an interview with Jeremy. He also did, Jeremy ran an AP for him and our friend Kat. So Daniel has been incredible. And Daniel has got an amazing new game coming out, by the way, called Wandering Blades.
Yes.
Which I'm so excited about. I saw a really early version of it, and I find, like, Wuja stuff is, like, that's my jam. It's really, really my jam, so I can't wait. I know it's going to be amazing. But, yeah, I think they're starting to build up towards the Kickstarter now, so I'm going to be all over that like a rash.
Daniel's fantastic. One of the first, like, big voices I remember like following and really identifying in the TTRPG scene of, like, this is somebody who is talking about the industry, who is talking to different people, who's talking about different games, who is interested in being a point of knowledge and learning and sharing all of that. He's incredible.
Nothing but positive things to say about Daniel and the whole Asians Represent team. Nothing but positivity for them. They are amazing.
But so the last question. The last question here before I let you go, and before we get to it, George, as always, thank you so much for taking time. Thank you as always for, you know, making space to be on my silly little show to talk about your cool thing. I love it.
I love it. We've been talking for 3 hours. This is incredible.
Yeah,
I love it.
I have the little recording timer over here. I am very, like, it means the world. I say this every time, but it is always, always true. It means the world to me that people are willing to take time during one of the most stressful times of their life, because I've been talking to so many people in the middle of their Kickstarters. It's so meaningful to me that people are willing to take time out of this, like, incredibly stressful, incredibly focused time to talk about this thing that they're so excited about. And that's why they're excited to talk about it. But it means the world. But so the last question, this is the three question. Every episode, the first episode I asked my guest star, the amazing star, her three favorite AP people, or her three favorite people she would have on her show. I loved it. It was a fun time. Every episode since that, I've asked like a three question, like, what is your three whatever? And I come up with it during the episode, and that's how we end out. We end out with a nice little goofy question. So, George, what are your three favorite fantastical creatures?
Oh, that is such a good question. Oh my God, I can narrow that down to three. Oh, that's so tough.
Yeah.
Okay, three favorite fantastical creatures.
It doesn't have to be in a particular order, but...
All right, so I really, really, really like... I learned relatively recently about the Wendigo. I don't... People pronounce it differently, right? I had known about it as like an abominable snowman-esque kind of thing, right? It's kind of like Sasquatch adjacent, mm-hmm. is how I understood it popularly. But that's actually just really not the case. I'm gonna have to bring up some information about this, but like the idea of it being like appetite embodied, I thought it was really, really, really interesting. The insatiable hunger. There's a thing in modern psychiatry called Wendigo psychosis, which is characterized by symptoms such as an intense craving for human flesh and fear of becoming a cannibal. And it's like a culture-bound syndrome. There's certain First Nations cultures where this is where this manifests. Mm-hmm. I love that idea of this like wandering appetite. And I don't know if you've seen the new Nosferatu yet.
No, not yet. We really want to.
So good. It's so good. So in that, Nosferatu describes himself as an appetite, nothing but an appetite. And I just, as soon as he mentioned that, as soon as that line was in, and I was like, oh, that's really, really good. My next one, there's so many to choose from. This really stumped me. There's The name has escaped me now. You should. I wish I'd had more time to prepare for this. There is a series of books by Marlon James called the Dark Star Trilogy. Dark Star Trilogy. Okay. I don't know if you've read any of them. Only two of them are out at the moment. The first one is called Black Leopard, Red Wolf. The next one is called Moon by the King. And they are the gayest books I've ever read. They are hella gay. I love it. So Marlon James is Jamaican, but it draws on... like particularly West African mythology, and it's kind of unfair of me to describe them as a mythical creature. It's not really, they're not creatures, they're people. But there are people in the book, and it's drawn from West African tradition, people called Sangoma, and they're like anti-witches. In Black Leopard, Red Wolf, the Sangoma, there's a character called who is a Sangoma that's really pivotal in the story, and they're kind of mythologized into almost creature status. And Black Leopard, Red Wolf is that it's, you know, no one is quite what they seem. The main character is the main character is referred to as the wolf, and he has like hypersensitive smelling, but one of his lovers is a werepanther, and it's absolutely amazing. So I'm just gonna say all of the creatures in the Dark Star trilogy are amazing. And then finally I'm gonna go again slightly off piste again, because it's not quite a creature, more of a presence, but sometimes it's embodied into a creature. So one of my things that I'm really, really interested in is folk horror, particularly English folk horror. So I wrote one of my undergraduate dissertations on psychedelic drugs and landscapes, and talking about naming things, I really liked this. I called the dissertation was titled Landscaped, and I capitalized the L, the S, and the D in landscaped, which I was very happy
about. I see what you did there. I see what we're picking up.
But like, so like, there is something intensely creepy about England. Like, this country is messed up, man, and there's something intensely creepy about England, not just rural England but urban England as well. So like, you've got the folk horror and the urban weird. And so like, this is going to be a weird one because it's not quite a creature, but I'm going to say that my third favorite mythical creature is the English landscape, which is often embodied into like witches and fairies and giant dogs and stuff like that, but all of them are rooted in the land. So that as a weird oblique third choice, I'm going to go with the English rural landscape is my third favorite mythical creature.
I like it because I'm a proponent of sometimes you got to be weird with it. And so if I give you an option of three, you got to pick three things. One of those had better be a weird thing that isn't technically the thing that I asked for. And that's correct. You're doing it correct if that's the case. If one of the things I ask you isn't really the thing that I asked you, no, that's fine. That counts. I love it.
I'm glad I've satisfied the criteria.
you gave me the thing that I wanted, which is weird things to talk about, and that's great. That was the assignment. But George, again, thank you so much. I'll let you go. It's getting late for both of us. so much time has passed. So many people have signed up for the Kickstarter. The links, again, I said this earlier, the links to everything will be in the show notes, links to the Kickstarter, link to 3Sail Studios, website, socials, all kinds of stuff will be in there. So if you haven't, please go check out the Kickstarter, go check out the preview document, you know, back it if you can, obviously. If you can't, tell your friends, share it with anybody, you know, share this episode with them. You know, nothing better for, you know, if you're excited about a game than to hear direct from the person who made it. But as a little sign off, George, you want to do like a little outro? I've been forgetting to do the intros. This is the second interview in a row that I forgot to do the intro at the start. For you,
Matt, thank you so much for having me, man. I really, really appreciate it. The work you're doing to uplift people is incredible. Like, you know, we're all practicing what we preach here, and I absolutely love it. Thank you to everyone listening. Like Matt, if you haven't gone and checked out Mappamundi on Kickstarter already, please do. We'd love to have you with us to start your journey into the wilds. We're doing a quick production turnaround. We're going to print the day after the Kickstarter finishes. So we're aiming to have books in people's hands by the summer. So you don't have to wait 18 months. The game is done. We're just finishing the artwork off, finishing the Kickstarter off, and then we're going straight to production. So yeah, if you're looking for a non-combat experience that's all about the fascination of, you know, exploring and learning new things and coming face to face with 50-foot tall snails with forests on their back, then Mapamundi's the game for you.
I mean, who wouldn't be interested in that, honestly?
Exactly. It should sell itself, right?
But this will be where we leave it. George, thank you again. Say bye, everybody. All right, there we go. George, thank you so much. This has been fantastic.
That was an absolute pleasure. We've literally it's been 3 hours and 10 minutes. It's been like, you know, I mean, I can talk for all England, but this was genuinely beautiful. I really enjoyed it.
No, it means the world. I'm glad that people are having a good time with it. I figured at the very least, you know, one of my favorite things has always been talking to people about the stuff they do, how they make it. I'm always curious about, I honestly talk less about the things that I want to ask, which is like, because I don't think it's interesting questions to ask for a podcast where I'm just like, how do you figure out how big you want the book to be? How do you figure out how much, like the paper, like the weight? Those are the silly questions that come to my brain. And I'm like, those aren't interesting questions to ask. I should ask like about the mechanics and the game.
I love that kind of stuff, man, because I think like there's so few resources. Like I was going to do a series because I used to do YouTube content creation for A Song of Ice and Fire tabletop miniature war game. And, like, that's how I got started doing this stuff. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to go back to it, and I was going to do a series called like Getting Games Made, like doing like the technical side of things, and talking to people about how do you plan a project, how do you do this, how do you do that, and getting designers on and stuff like that to talk about those kinds of things as well. Like, I think there's definitely room for that kind of stuff, an appetite for it.
Yeah, I might do another podcast. I think there's a difference. There's a different focus, right? I want people to talk about their game as a thing. I don't want to say a product, but you know what I mean? Like as a thing, as a thing for people to play and to be excited about. Because I also want people that aren't just TTRPG people to be on. I just have a glut of them because that's a major community that I'm in.
I think there's absolutely space for it. Maybe we could even do it together, getting games made.
I'd be down. I, honestly, part of the fun is this has been just learning how to produce it, learning how to put it together, learning what goes into like hosting and.
This is what stopped me doing it is because I've got three jobs. I was like, I can't do the side of things. Like I'm a bit of a natural host. Let's send me a message. Let's talk some more about this. I think there's fertile ground for something like this.
Yeah, I'm always down. I'm always down.
It comes with a little bit more clout when I actually have a game out rather than just speculating. I think we should put plans into action.
Yeah, I'm down for it. I'm down to at least be a sounding board, if nothing else, you know? I'm down to, like you said, knowledge share.
Yeah, let's do it. We'll talk about it.
Hell yeah. That's part two and the finale of my time with George from Three Sails. Again, I want to thank him so much for taking so much time to chat with me about Three Sails, you know, the sort of development, his ideas behind it, Mapamundi. We had a fantastic time chatting. You can find all the links for George, Three Sails, Mapamundi, and its final week on Kickstarter down in the description. If you haven't backed it, please go check it out. Please go download the quick start. Give it a read. Check it out. I think it's an amazing, amazing game, amazing design of a game. It has been absolutely a smash hit on Kickstarter, which is fantastic to see. And hey, if you back it after listening to this, tell them you heard about it here. And, you know, hey, that would be cool. All the links for the show and my stuff will be in the show notes. You can go check that out. Thank you, as always, to people who are rating and reviewing the show. Thank you to everybody on Patreon. Thank you for everybody who listens, who tells their friends, who shares it on social media. I've had a couple people share it on social media and kind of at me about it. And that's amazing. It's so cool to have people say that they like your stuff. That's just a good time. I have some really exciting interviews lined up that I'm very excited to bring you. But until next time, take care.